Hello, Rebecca Weaver here. I'm pleased to bring you an interview I did with poet Patricia Smith last year when she came to read in the Poetry at Tech series. This is a bit longer than our usual podcast, but I think you'll find it's worth it. Happy listening.
Hello and welcome to the Textile Podcast. Textile is an online forum for digital pedagogy and research produced by the Marion L. Britton Fellows in Digital Pedagogy at Georgia Tech in Atlanta, Georgia. The Britton Fellowship offers an opportunity for new scholars to develop innovative teaching and scholarship in communication. The podcast was developed to broaden Textile's reach, as well as attend to the multimodal curriculum of the Writing and Communication program. I'm thrilled to have Patricia Smith here as our guest today. Patricia Smith, lauded by critics as a testament to the power of words to change lives, is the author of six acclaimed poetry volumes. Blood Dazzler, which chronicles the devastation wreaked by Hurricane Katrina, was a finalist for the 2008 National Book Award. Should Have Been Jimmy Savannah, Coffee House Press 2002, a memoir in verse, was a finalist for the William Carlos Williams Award from the Poetry Society of America. Smith is currently at work on a biography of Harriet Tubman and a collection of short fiction and a coffee table book combining poetry with 19th century photos of African Americans. Smith's previous book, Tea House of the Almighty, was a National Poetry Series selection and winner of the first ever Hurston Wright Award in Poetry. Her other poetry books are Close to Death, Big Town's Big Talk, and Life According to Motown, which was recently re-released in the special 20th anniversary edition. She's the winner of the Rattle Poetry Prize, the Chautauqua Literary Journal Award in Poetry, and two Pushcart Prizes. Patricia Smith was long ago one of the McEver Poetry Chairs here. Welcome back to Tech, Patricia.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
We are so happy to have you here. Our mission in this writing and communication program is to give students experience and skill development in diverse modes: written, oral, verbal, electronic, and nonverbal. We call it the woven curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to interview you for our podcast today because the way you communicate in various modes, poems for the page, poems for the stage, recordings, tweets, Facebook posts, and now biography, is
sign language. Yeah.
Sign language.
I'm all there.
It's pretty extraordinary. And my first question is, how do you manage the transitions between all of those different modes?
They don't feel like transitions. I never stopped and said, okay, I think I've gone as far as I can with this. Time to move on to this next thing. They just sort of melded organically somehow. I think it had a lot to do with being introduced to poetry by getting up on stage and doing it. And so to me, that was the primal movement. I'm standing in front of a room full of strangers. I have to get you to feel the way that I feel. I've got 3 minutes, or I've got half an hour if I'm doing a feature or something. And that would normally be something that would come later. You kind of build your way up to that, you know. And I was totally happy with that. I hadn't thought about publication. I wasn't thinking about anything else, except that was my world for a long time. You know, the idea that I was living in this city, there was this really vibrant literary community that I knew nothing about. I walked right into it, and it was just what I needed at the time, and I was there for as long as I needed it. When the whole kind of, I hate the term spoken word, and I can't think of what else to say, but when we started to get older, we started to talk more, we started to leap over that chasm that had developed where the so-called academic poets and the so-called performance poets were glaring at each other like they didn't all use language.
Yeah.
And I thought that was obscene. So I said, okay, we're all starting with the same canvas. Why is it that I can't fill my canvas the same way you do? I mean, we're both using words. Right. And so some of us started to kind of explore. It's like, well, what's going on over here? And what's the muscle and bone of what we're doing? Maybe we need to go over here and see what's going on. And it wasn't, you know, like we screeched to a halt and said, okay, here we are, academic poets, you know. It's just that we realized that we were all storytellers at heart. And there were just different ways of telling stories. So, and I didn't think, oh, well, now I have to stop and learn all this new stuff. I just figured if I kept being passionate about what I was doing, that whatever was going to happen was going to happen, no matter what realm that it was in. And that's how it wound up working.
What was the most surprising thing about that explorative journey?
Surprising. Probably the idea that I didn't have to learn much to kind of span from one area to the other. I was really in awe of a lot of, you know, once you realize who you should be reading. Okay, I wasn't really concerned about that. I was, I loved listening to people. You know, I'd go to an open mic and there would be a pump jockey, there would be a guy who bagged groceries, there would be an ex-con, there would be a teacher, a secretary, a mother, you know, and for all those people, it was very important for them at that moment to be in that space.
Right.
And that's what fueled everything for me. So I didn't know who I was supposed to be reading and you know, who the important poets were and why they were important and who influenced them and who they had influenced.
Yeah.
And there was a part of me who thought, well, you really, without knowing that, you can't really be, you're not really a poet.
Huh.
You know, you're just pushing people's buttons. I mean, this is, a lot of this was coming in, you know, over my ear from other people saying, well, no, you're not sanctioned. You didn't go to the right schools. You don't, you know, you don't have a book out yet. And it was sort of a dueling thing. On one hand, I was saying, oh, there's so much work I need to do to become a poet, while it was happening, you know.
And while you were already a poet.
I was already a poet. It was happening. I just wasn't sure if all of a sudden music would start playing and someone would put a big pendant, you know, around your neck and say, you are now sanctioned. I didn't know if that was going to happen,
yeah.
You know, and the best thing just felt like, I'll just keep doing what I'm doing. And I guess surprising was that I was in that world and in the other world and pretty much rooted there before I knew it, you know, and without any idea of this is how it happened, step one, step two, step three. I think that I stared at some people across this divide, and we both saw parallel passion and interest, and you know, and I think they remembered why they started writing poems in the first place, and I remembered the same thing, and that's where we met.
Yeah.
Granted, there are still people saying, where'd you come from? You know,
who are you?
Yeah,
I've
gone to places and done readings, and it's like, well, I don't know who you are. You know, they make a big deal out of it.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't trade one moment of it because I think right now I'm at the perfect juncture of having that the rawness to the work and having the spontaneity and the inevitability of the work. And also knowing where I'm rooted in the canon.
Mm.
You know, nobody I'm afraid to read with. There's no place I'm afraid to go and read. It took me a while in my own head to feel legitimized.
Mm.
And that's a problem with the whole process. That there's supposed to be a dictated way that you come up no matter how. I mean, there are people I started in the poetry slam with who are still, you know, taking trips on Greyhound and sleeping on futons and performing for Pass the Hat.
Right.
So you have to keep asking yourself, why am I here?
Yeah.
Why did I get started in the first place? And where do I want to wind up? How do I want to be remembered? How do, you know, what do I want people saying 10 years from now? You know, and if you want them to just say that was one cool guy and we had some great nights getting drunk, then that's fine.
Woo-hoo!
Yeah, yeah, that's okay.
Yeah. One of the things that we tell our students here is that we don't want them to forget any languages that they bring in with them. Instead, we want them to learn more and to develop skill at code switching. And many of us will actually use that term in the classroom. I say, you know, you talk to me differently probably than you talk to my grandma or your grandma. And, you know, you talk to your girlfriend or your boo differently than you talk to, say, me. So you already know how to do this. You already have this skill.
Mm-hmm.
What I need you to do is try on this persona or voice, to try these new codes so you can succeed here in this place, this community of academia. And it sounds like you consciously went through learning and picking up new codes. And now you've got them, and you don't even really think anymore about which one you're using. It just happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was raised that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my parents came up from the South during the Great Migration, settled in Chicago. So I was first generation up North.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother's way of introducing me to the world was basically to say, okay, now you need to be as white as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need to speak differently. You need to, you know, your mannerisms should be different. And in order to do that, we're going to bus you all the way across the city of Chicago to a school where eventually there were 800 people in my graduating class and 12 African Americans.
Wow.
So I was just talking to my class about this the other day. I would get on the bus and I would be one person. And it was almost as if I was shedding layers as I was crossing the city, and I would get off, and I would be Miss Tri-Hi-Y. Hi, guys. And I couldn't I couldn't come back home and be that.
Right.
So, and it was funny. I mean, I did that for years, and it wasn't like, it's like, oh, there's the school in view. I better change what I'm doing. It's amazing how you internalize that. You know, I mean, years later, I would, one of the first trips that I took as a poet and where I was teaching was with a group of sixth graders in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
And the area that I was in had a high incidence of drug use. And I was there, oh, I'm here to teach you poetry. And their realities were totally different. Their realities were what my realities were when I was their age.
Mm-hmm.
But I had forgotten that, you know, what that was like. And I guess I've had a lot of teaching situations like this where the kids have been told so much that their voices aren't legitimate, that you can't just come in and say, hi, I'm going to do a poetry workshop. You have to let them know that what you say here and the way you say it is absolutely fine, and that it's okay to build other voices on top of that without feeling like you're betraying that original voice. And that's a really, it's a difficult thing to understand, because I still know who I am, you know. I still, you know, I can be in a reading. I mean, I was in tears. I was all of a sudden at the Academy of American Poets award thingy. I'm sure they're thrilled I'm calling it that. you know, and I look around, and these people who had been so elevated in my head, you know, are sitting right next to me, and Carolyn Forché is saying, oh, I always get so nervous at these things. And we're talking like,
oh,
you know,
gosh,
two girlfriends and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was amazing when I thought about the span of that world and how I felt, had reached a point where I felt comfortable in all of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think the common denominator is the storyteller. I think that you take a story, you figure out where it best belongs, how best to tell it, and you stay focused on that. You stay true to that. And so then your story from, you know, being a 13-year-old kid on the west side of Chicago can stand alongside, I'm going to say Carolyn Forché again, because
she told
me this story.
Yeah.
You know, the first time she was on a merry-go-round and she looked over and there was a black girl next to her and she wanted to reach out and touch her hair.
Wow.
You know, and to me, they were like parallel stories.
Yeah.
You know, so I think we've been told so often that in order to succeed in some way, either creatively or professionally, that we have to abandon that first voice and replace it with another voice. Mm-hmm. And then as things happen, abandon that voice. And like it's like this ladder of voices until we get to the grand successful voice that will serve us for the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
And I think the texture in both our work and our lives comes from learning how to use that original voice as a root and adding on to it, but never losing it.
Almost, instead of a ladder, it's more of a toolbox where you can lay the tools out on the table and pick them as you go.
Well, it's funny because that's the way I think about learning to write in form.
I
knew, and it was interesting because when you're on stage a lot, you automatically care about how the poem hits the air.
Right.
So when I decided I really want to know, why is it I keep picking up the same poem over and over again and reading it out loud, someone else's work? What is it? And I realized that it's something the poet had done technically to help heighten my response to the poem. And I was intensely curious, like, how do you do that? How do you weave that in a poem without it becoming the whole poem? And so I just decided I'm going to take a year, and that's what I'm going to, you know, that's what I'm going to do. It kind of became something, you know, I mean, I was enamored of form for a long time, and I, all of a sudden everything I would write would be in form, you know.
Yeah.
Until you realize that it's something you fold into your signature, doesn't become your signature, and I always look at it as plumping the toolbox, because then when you realize you have a story to tell, I know if I have to write an elegy. I know there's a form that lends itself to elegy. I know if I need the poem to feel and sound chaotic, that there are things that I can do with the form to make the, you know, to, I'm showing the reader how to read the poem. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it is the toolbox. And you could put it in and never use them. Mm-hmm. But it's giving your story, whatever story you have to tell, more of a chance, because you have more ways, more avenues to funnel it through, or whatever, until you can see. Because we all have those poems and stories that we've had for years, and something's quite, you know, something about it's not quite right, and we don't know. Yeah. And I think sometimes the stories are asking us for something that we do not yet know how to do. And so the plumper the toolbox is, the more of a chance that that story will survive.
Patricia, I want to keep talking about this idea of storytelling, specifically with the persona poem 34 in your book, Blood Dazzler, where you take on different voices. These are the people who perished in the aftermath of Katrina in the nursing home, and they were abandoned. And you, in one of the readings that you give of this poem, you talk about how you feel like you, through this poem, you want to give them all at least a line. And I want to ask you a little bit about persona poems, especially now that you're known for more than being, you know, just a slam poet. That was in air quotes. do you find that you have to read differently, and then also read differently when you're reading personas? How do you work that so that you feel you can carry it off? I mean, it's, in most of the readings, they're 8 or 9 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the really short poem with that really bright or dark shot of power that a lot of slam poems tend to be.
Sure, yeah. In terms of reading it differently, I don't. Mm. I have to, I guess I have more confidence in myself to carry it out for a longer time. And this poem, especially 34, because the voices were so varied.
Mm-hmm.
Two things happen, though. I mean, so I used to write persona poems because I thought, wow, there's so much power in that, and it gets me out of the way. And I would write that short, you know, dramatic spurt of, yeah. And now I'm more concerned with the best way to tell this story. I mean, think about it. That's the poem that actually I didn't start out to write a book. That's the first poem I wrote, and the book kind of built up around it later.
Yeah.
So that poem was really important to me. And it could have gone any way. I could have taken that event and written, you know, hopefully one solid poem as a witness, or, my God, look at what we do to our elderly, or something like that. And I think it's my background in, I always tell my students, always look for an unexpected entry point to the poem.
Right.
And so persona is always one of the first things that I think about. Could this be really effective as a persona poem? And originally, I didn't think it could because there were so many people involved, unless I had picked out, you know, one personality and done that.
Right.
But during Katrina, there were so many tragedies piled on top of tragedies that we really stopped seeing faces.
Right.
You know, by the time we would focus on something, something would, you know, attract us over here, and we were just so buffeted about.
Right.
And so I guess my primary reason for writing it was to slow things down and to have, it was like a camera moving around the room, and it would light on this person and then this person and it would go over here. And I only wanted them to say one thing. You know, I only wanted them to say one thing.
Yeah.
And in the performance, though, it's interesting with any persona poem, it starts out being very much in my voice. And I believe, and this sounds kind of mystical every time I say it, but I think the more you do a persona piece, eventually the piece will tell you how it wants to sound.
Oh.
I mean, I've got that poem about a skinhead, and when I was first reading it, it sounded very much like me. And then at one point, I remember starting it, and I could feel like this little weird accent Mm-hmm. You know, this kind of regional mm-hmm. twang thing happening with his voice. And it wasn't me saying, oh, I think I'll put this way. Yeah. You know, eventually, if you believe enough in your persona, it will take root in you and become what it needs to be.
Yeah.
So now when I do 34, I have a very distinct vision in my head of each one of those people. Mm-hmm. They have mm-hmm. no names in the poem, but they have names in my head.
Right.
You know, and it's like me coming back to visit them and again for that moment.
Yeah.
So you'll hear that each 33, actually, since mm-hmm. one of them is silent,
mm-hmm.
but you'll hear a distinct difference in their voices and in cadence and things like that. And that's the only way I could really tell the story so that mm-hmm. people in an audience can close their eyes and they can see those people as clearly as I see them now when mm-hmm. I do the piece.
Those two poems, I was just thinking about the difference in performance. I think one of the things that tends to surprise our students is when we tell them, you have to practice speaking in public. Mm-hmm. You have to practice thinking about how you come off to an audience. And just the differences between those two poems are incredible. But your style, for example, the Death Jam reading of Skinhead, and one of the more recent readings that you've done of 34, I found incredibly right for each poem and incredibly right for that moment, especially when I'm listening to a long poem or reading.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's going to be a long poem if I know it.
Yeah.
I put my elbows down on my knees and I just sort of sink down because I don't feel that I can really be in my own body when I'm listening to a poem like mm-hmm. that, because mm-hmm. I want to let it take me over.
Right, right.
And I'm just curious about, has anybody in the audience ever said to you how different those experiences have been with each poem? Do you have sort of long-time fans that remark on that? Or do you feel, is it an act of, all right, here we are, I'm going to be in this poem now? And then is it easy to just go to the next one, or do you have to do...
Oh, it's not easy. Well, the thing that's odd about Skinhead, and with the advent of social media and everything being online, it used to be that I would go into a classroom or a school or something, and I was just new.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'd have to introduce myself mm-hmm. and talk a little bit. And now I go in, and they've already seen everything that's on.
Yeah.
And they always ask me to do Skinhead. So Skinhead, I have a strange relationship with it. It's almost like my Freebird, you know.
Yeah.
And there's sometimes I don't, you know, at 8 a.m. in a high school cafeteria loaded with kids, I don't feel like doing it.
Right.
I mean, and I have to kind of explain to people that it's the persona has reached the point where it comes, but I don't pull it up all the time. I just can't mm-hmm. say and be what they saw on YouTube. You know,
yeah.
I mean, sometimes it's quieter than that. It's more contemplative. Sometimes mm-hmm. it sounds violent. Sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, and it depends on how my guy feels that day.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
I haven't had anybody, for so many people, especially young people, that's like the pinnacle to them. It's like, oh my God, did you see that? Well, you know,
yeah.
and that's fine. And that's one of the reasons I kind of keep doing it, because, you know, I say you don't have to start out being familiar with your persona. As a matter of fact, it should be as much of a learning experience for you as it is for the audience,
yeah.
you know, when you're writing it and when you do it. I've never had anybody compare the two things so much. I think I had a long time when I didn't do a lot of persona. Early on, it's just like everything.
Yeah.
I get an idea. It's like, oh, persona. Oh, I'll be a grocery bag. I'll be a, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just like any other device. You can wear it out, you know. So
right.
now, we're talking about the toolbox,
mm-hmm.
now you understand when it's the best way to tell a story, you know. And in those two instances, which were very, very different in style and their approach and subject matter, it wound up being, I need to hear somebody's voice other than my own, you know. And because my voice is varied, you know, it's strange. I hear my students sometimes, I'll hear them outside before class, and they'll be so animated and so alive and wonderful. And then you get them in class and you say the word poem and they go, you know, yeah. And then all of a sudden they're overly formal or, you know, twicks and thou, and you know, and you're like, yeah, you got to be joking me. Or they're doing something about the terrible college love poem.
Yeah.
You know, and I said, no. I just heard you talking about that outside, and it was much more lively, much more. Why now? Because you're in class, and then I've asked you to do this. You know, so I think that the difference between those two pieces is the difference in those two slices of life, mm-hmm. the difference in the environment, the difference in voice. I can't do everything at 90 miles an hour. I can't do everything at 30 miles an hour. You know, yeah. It's like the skinhead's coming from a very, 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 very different place. Mm-hmm. So it takes a little head homework, I think,
mm-hmm.
to say, okay, first of all, I know this person's not me. So who are they? And one of the things I tell my students, I said, when you're in the grocery store, try to figure out what the person you're writing about would be putting in the cart. Even though it's not part of your poem, it's like, what is this guy who's very much turned into himself, who's very bitter, who spends a lot of time alone, what's in his grocery cart?
Yeah.
You know, let's open their medicine cabinet. What's in the medicine cabinet? Mm-hmm. You know, and just to say, I'm not... This persona isn't just with me for the instance of writing the poem.
Right.
Because that's never going to work. They have to inhabit you for a time before that and hopefully for a long time afterwards.
Yeah. My last question for you, Patricia, is when you're working on a new poem and you're still trying to figure it out, where is this poem going? What does it want to be? What do I want it to be? What do I need it to be? When do you know? Do you have a moment? Is it a slow kind of creeping sensibility as you write? Does it come as sometimes a shock or a feeling of sudden enlightenment from the heavens? How do you know this poem is going where it needs to go?
Well, I think about two different types of poems. One is the driven poem, where you are running over people to get to your keyboard or to your notebook because it has to be written right now. Something happened. It's some primal emotion that's driving you to the page. You can do that. The other one is you hear something and you go, that'd be a really interesting idea. And you jot it down in a notebook and maybe you attach a couple of notes to it. You come back to it a week after that. So one of them very urgently needs to be what I need it to be, because I want to get it out. That's my background in performance, that when I write something, other half of the writing of it is the performing of it. Like I used to write last lines first because I knew how I wanted the audience to feel.
There's
something in me that doesn't, the final stamp isn't put on a poem until it's out of the air. And the sooner, and I have the relationship I have with my audience, I'm never, I am poet, you are audience, I'm about to impart my wisdom, you know. Sometimes I'll say, I just wrote this, I'm not sure about the ending, what do you guys think, you know. I have no problem saying it with an audience, you know.
Yeah.
But the feel that comes to me from an audience when I'm done with a poem goes a long way toward letting me know what. So the performing and the writing still go hand in hand. Even though I'm not performing in the same way that I was, you know, 10, 15 years ago, I still think poems meant to be, it's a conversation. I still want to tell the story. I can write the story, I need to tell it, and then I need to see or hear your response to it. To say, yes, now it's what. Because it can be what I want it to be to me.
Right.
But that would indicate that I'm just writing for myself, and I'm not, you know. And then sometimes on the page, there's a twist, there's a line where I've played with the language a little bit, where I go, now there's two things going on. One is the story is being told. The other thing is I'm trying to do something new with the language. So the unexpected entry point and the language it deserves. So this is like I'm writing two poems at once, you know. And when those two things come together, then I go, okay, somebody's going to hear something in this poem that's worded in a way that is absolutely perfect, but they have never heard it that way before.
Right.
And that in revision, or that's the hardest thing to do. You can get the story down relatively
right.
quickly.
Right.
But I think if I'm being driven to a story, so are 800 other people.
Yeah.
You
right.
know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, lately I've been thinking a lot about the missing plane. Who
mm-hmm.
hasn't?
Yeah.
You know, I'm one of those people that I need a black box, like, now.
Yeah.
You can crash, but mm-hmm. I need to know why.
Right.
And then I'm okay.
Right.
And
right.
I don't have that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've been thinking about that a lot. But, you know, if you're a writer, you're buffeted about so much, you go, you're on the verge of going crazy
mm-hmm.
all the time
mm-hmm.
because every time you,
mm-hmm.
you walk out your door, there's ideas hurtling at you,
right.
you know.
Right.
So doing something to make, stamping your signature on something, like I would, if you were in a class of mine,
mm.
if anyway, you're not going to be in a class of mine, but if you were in a class of mine, you know, one of the things I do at the end of class is everybody writes something without their names on them. I said,
yeah.
I need to know who you are. I need to be able
mm-hmm.
to identify you.
Mm-hmm.
So when a poem is finished for me, it's, I feel like I can get that poem out in the world without my name on it. And
mm-hmm.
that somebody will know, oh, that's her because of the way that word turns or that, you know, that phase in the story is told a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
So the signature, I think, is kind of the last thing on
mm-hmm.
it.
Well, I think we're going to have to leave it there. Patricia Smith, this has been a great conversation.
Well,
thank you. Thank you so much.
Sure, no problem.
Join us next time for the Textile Podcast. Thanks to Chi, our producer.
Yay, Chi.
Thanks so much for listening, and join us next time for more discussion of digital pedagogy and teaching. Our new theme music is from Mother Banjo. You can find recordings, tour dates, and swag at motherbanjo.com.